It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up this hour, it's our regular Teach Me What You Know segment. Today, how to perform well on a job interview. First, we're joined by a philosophy professor who finds meaning in life on the run with his pack of dogs.
Mark Rowlands is here to talk about why he runs, how running with his dogs and one-time wolf changed him, and his thoughts on mortality. Mark is a professor of philosophy at the University of Miami and the author of Running with the Pack. Mark, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Veronica. How are you?
Doing all right.
Good, good.
Well, your wolf, Brennan, is a big reason you started running. Can you set the stage for us where you were in life when you started running with a pack?
Yeah, when I was 27, I did something a bit stupid. Well, probably many things stupid, actually, but this is the only one I remember, let's say. So when I bought Brennan, he was a sort of six-week-old wolf cub. At least he sold him as a wolf. I suspect he was a sort of high-contact wolf dog. But whatever he was, he had certain sort of idiosyncrasies, which basically involved him eating everything I owned if I left him on his own for more than a couple of minutes. And I suppose one day my reflections were sort of disturbed by the sound of sort of loud thuds coming from the room out the back of the house. And you know, when Brennan was a cub, he had this game. He used to take a cushion off the armchair and tear off out the garden. You know, it was a game of chase, basically. He wanted me to chase him. And it was a good game. But one day he decided to modify it, and the loud thuds I heard, he decided instead of taking the cushion, it might be a good idea to take the rest of the armchair too. And the loud thuds I heard was the sound of the chair, you know, sort of locked firmly in his jaws, being repeatedly slammed against the frame of the back door. And I suppose it was at precisely this moment that I decided that, you know, all things considered, it might be really, really good if Brennan were constantly exhausted. And that's how my life of running as an adult began, I suppose.
Slamming an armchair against a wall, I'm guessing that's something only a big wolf could pull off.
Yeah, well, he wasn't even fully grown. He was only about 6 months
wow.
old at the time. So,
well, when you first began running, you had a little bit of athlete envy. Your wolf, Brennan, looked so much more effortless at the run than you did. You write about how he seemed like he was floating a couple of inches above the ground. How did running with a sleek predator like that change your runs?
Well, no, apart from the sort of the mild case of species envy, I suppose, you know, it didn't really change it that much. I mean, I suppose, you know, in hindsight, the whole idea of running this dog into tiredness didn't really work because, you know, as I got fitter, he got fitter, and then, you know, used to sort of plunge him into an exhausted sleep for the rest of the day. Now he just regarded as a sort of gentle loosener, you know. So I did a lot of running in those days, basically through necessity.
Now, as you've run over the years, your animal companions have changed. You've lost Brennan. You've lost other dogs as well. And you've had to take on new, younger dogs. You talk about sort of how you feel like you're getting older and then younger again in the process. But through all that, why do you prefer running with dogs when other athletes might like to run with a pack of other runners?
Yeah, I suppose there's a certain... being a philosophy professor, I suppose I'm supposed to think for a living, and there's a certain kind of point on the run where I sort of reach a point where things go very well. I call it the sort of heartbeat of the run, and I found that dogs they tend to sort of augment or accentuate the heartbeat of the run. So, you know, running beside me, there's not just my breath and my rhythm, but also, you know, the click, click, click of their claws on the tarmac, the pant of their breaths, the sort of jingle of their chains. And this all kind of, you know, melds and fuses together and forms something like what I think of anyway as a heartbeat. And it's in the heartbeat of the run that, you know, various things that I've been working on, you know, over the preceding weeks or months, various problems I've been trying to solve, they often just seem to solve themselves, you know.
Well, as a philosopher, you've been doing something that you write has kind of gone out of favor. You're thinking about the meaning of life as you run, or at least you're experiencing it as you run. How would you say running connects you with the question of the meaning of life?
Yeah, I suppose that the book isn't about running. Well, it is about running, but it's also about the meaning of life. And the basic idea is that the things we do in life, they divide into two kind of broad sorts. There are things we do only for the sake of other things, like being paid, for example. Work would be the classic example. But there are a small number of things that we, you know, we do for their own sake, just to do them. And the first sort of things, the things we do for the sake of other things, they have a certain sort of value that philosophers call instrumental value. Their value is as instruments or tools to get you something else. But the things we do for their own sake, they have a different kind of value altogether. It's what's sometimes called intrinsic value. And, you know, when you think about how I started off running, that I was basically trying to save the small number of things I still owned, you know, from the activities of a rapacious canine. That's a very kind of instrumental origin, you know, to why I run. But I suppose over the years, this sort of transformed, and there just came a certain point when I realized that I was running just to run, you know, for no other reason, not for health, not because the dogs needed it, not for the quality of thought that it sort of produced, but I was just running in order to run. And I think it's in those sorts of moments that you kind of realize that what's really important in life are the things that have intrinsic value, whether this is other people would be the standard example, but it's also, I think, and this was the sort of the point of the book, it's those little things we do in life that we do for their own sake and not for the sake of something else.
Well, you talk a bit about philosophers as you contemplate running, and I wonder if you think that any of their views on life line up with what you feel when you're running.
I suppose there are different stages to a run, you know, if you run long enough. And in the first stage, you know, I'm sort of fully embodied self, you know, because when you get to my age, you're either injured or you're about to get injured, you know. And so my attention is sort of keenly tuned to any kind of bodily disturbance. You know, what does this tightening in my calf mean? You know, should I stop or should I stretch and go on and so on? So I'm fully kind of, this sort of corresponds to the philosophical view known as materialism, associated with philosophers like Thomas Hobbes and people like that. But then after a certain sort of stage, you get to what I call the Cartesian phase of the run, after the philosopher René Descartes, who distinguished between the body. The body is always one thing, it's a physical thing, a physical organism, just like the bodies of other creatures. But there's also a mind, a non-physical thing. And this is the sort of stage where I get to in the second part of the run, where I'm sort of telling myself little lies, like, you know, get me to the corner of 104th and then you can walk for a while, and things like that. And as if there is this sort of mind which is in control, and the body is just this, is basically just the dupe. But then there's another stage, and after that, the sort of mind kind of breaks down. There's no longer really a mind there doing the thinking. There are just various thoughts which seem to come from nowhere and often disappear just as quickly. And this is kind of like the view of the mind associated with the Scottish philosopher David Hume, who thought that we were just a bundle of thoughts and feelings and emotions, and there's nothing else sort of to us. And so what we have, I think, in each sort of successive phase of the run is a gradual kind of shrinking of the self, from this fully embodied self to this disembodied mind to this sort of bundle of thoughts. And so I think there are parallels between, you know, the history of a run as you start off and then gradually make your way home in a sort of semi-exhausted state, to the way the history of philosophy developed over the past couple of thousand years.
Now, you've run in different countries, in different climates, with different companion animals, and obviously you've thought about a lot about the meaning of life as you do it. And I know from reading your book that you don't believe in an afterlife, but if you did, what run would you want to relive as your version of heaven?
Oh, you know, in the summer, I sort of returned, I suppose, to the place I grew up. It was in southeast Wales, and my parents moved away when I was around about 20. So I hadn't been back for about 30 years, and I was running along the river there, the River Wye, with my dog Hugo, who came over with us. And there was something that felt very right about that run, and I couldn't put my finger on it until I realized a few days later. Well, I was running with a dog, as I would have when I was a kid. On one side of me there was this river, and on the other side there were these sort of plunging hillsides. And I think that's why it felt right. I have no real memories of running when I was a kid. I just sort of, hardly any anyway. I sort of remember that I ran with a dog, but I don't really have many concrete kind of memories of it. I think this feeling of rightness was the form that those memories kind of took. And I can't really think of a run I've sort of enjoyed more than that. So that would have to be one of the leading candidates, I guess.
Well, Mark, thank you so much for coming on and talking about it today.
Thank you, Veronica. Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
We've been talking to Mark Rowlands, a professor of philosophy at the University of Miami. He's the author of Running with the Pack. And by the way, we have a picture of Mark from a while ago with his original running companion, Brennan, a gigantic wolf that's worth checking out on our page.
According to a new CNN poll, a majority of Americans, 55%, support the legalization of marijuana in the United States. That number jumped up 12 points from the previous year.
And other recent polls have shown similar results. Both Pew and Gallup also showed a majority in support of legalization. It's a major shift in attitudes in the United States, but why did the shift happen and why so quickly?
Joining us now to help us answer those questions is Martin Lee. He's the author of the book Smoke Signals, A Social History of Marijuana, Medical, Recreational, and Scientific. Martin, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much. Good to be with you.
Well, according to the poll that prompted this discussion, support for legalizing marijuana has been going way up over the last quarter century. Back in 1987, it was just 16%, up to 26% in the 90s, 34%, 43% a couple years ago, and now majority support. What accounts for this fairly quickly changing attitude, do you think?
Oh, I think it's several factors. One is that generally, people's experience with marijuana has been relatively benign, if not positive. It hasn't had the negatives that people thought may have been associated with it. But also, people have witnessed the medical marijuana experiment in California that began in 1996 and other states that followed accordingly. And the result really wasn't that bad. There was no, the sky didn't fall. The predictions of chaos and calumny just didn't transpire. So I think it's based on people's experience and a general distrust or cognitive dissonance with respect to the government. I think there's a lot of anger toward government in general in the United States at this point, and part of the focus of that reflects in terms of the distrust or the disbelief of what the federal government is saying about marijuana, which is that it is a dangerous substance with no medical value, and people see that that's basically not the case.
One of the most striking things I thought about the poll, back in 1987, when asked if smoking pot is immoral, 70% said, yeah, it's immoral. Now only 35% say that. So, I mean, apart from health concerns and things like that, there's just a very different moral attitude toward marijuana use.
I think in general there's shifting morals in the United States, not just with respect to marijuana consumption, but gay and lesbian rights and so forth. But the poll you cited from 1987, we have to remember that was the peak of the Just Say No era. Ronald Reagan was president, and there was a heavy, concerted effort on the part of the government to peg marijuana as the evil weed, to bring back that attitude or imagery that really goes back to the 1930s when marijuana was first banned by the federal government. So part of it is, I think, the federal government and the resource it's putting into depicting marijuana in a certain way. But after a while, that negative image just doesn't hold water because it doesn't tally with people's experience.
We're talking about attitudes. We're starting to see a lot of action. First, you mentioned medical marijuana being legalized in more and more states. And now, this year, Colorado has its recreational marijuana sales legalization in effect as of last week, I believe, and Washington's will be coming into place later this year. Do you expect to see more dominoes falling state by state?
I wouldn't be surprised. I'm a journalist. I don't like to prognosticate about the future. I don't have a crystal ball. But what will unfold in Colorado and Washington as a result of legalization, I don't think you're going to see, millions of people rushing to try marijuana for the first time because they want to, become recreational users. Most people in the United States who want to smoke marijuana are already doing so. I think where you're going to see a significant impact, again, is the medical sphere, because there's now these new types of marijuana products that are not very psychoactive. They don't get you high, and yet they have very significant therapeutic results. I think it's in this area you're going to see a lot more people who are not involved with the marijuana subculture begin to warm up to it. So I think, you know, as the experiments unfold in Colorado and Washington, when people in other states see, again, that the sky doesn't fall, that predictions of ruin, you know, don't transpire, it's more likely that other states will follow suit if they can discern a tangible benefit, for example, tax money being raised from the new laws and so forth. That's something that could sway legislatures in other states.
Among the things that people are still concerned about in Colorado now in particular is that legal pot will be cheaper pot, and it's going to be more available and affordable for teenagers who may suffer really significant health consequences if they start using it at an early age. Are you worried about that?
Well, again, you know, most people, whether they're teenagers or grown-ups, if they want to access cannabis in the United States, whether it's in a legal state or not, they can do so. That phenomenon is already happening. I don't think we're going to see, you know, huge numbers of new people coming on board because they've been waiting for the law to change to try marijuana. If you're a young person, you want to try it, you're probably already doing, whether it's for good or for ill. And as for young people and its effect on young people, you know, it's quite ironic, I might say almost poignantly so, that in state after state today, in very unlikely places like Utah and Alabama and Florida and Kentucky, parents are demanding that their state legislatures change the law to make marijuana legal so that their children who are desperately ill with catastrophic seizure disorders and other kind of things can access a medicine that appears to help others in with similar situations. So after all these years about hearing how marijuana prohibition was really about protecting the children, ironically, you know, it's the children in desperate need of some kind of remedy or relief for their condition that is propelling a kind of a nationwide surge now for legalization that goes beyond just Colorado and Washington. As for the health impact of young people, teenagers, and so forth using street marijuana, you know, that's a tricky issue and should be looked at carefully. But I can say one should be very, very careful about taking federal officials at their word when they proclaim negative things about marijuana, because their credibility is really in question given their track record in the past. And there really is no scientific consensus at all that actually marijuana is harmful to the brain, whether it's a young brain or older brain. That's not to say that people should be using it or should take it lightly, but the scientific consensus is not there. What the scientific consensus shows with respect to marijuana, that it actually affects the brain in a way that activates certain receptors that actually have a protective effect against the toxicity of alcohol, for example, and other toxins that could actually harm the brain. I know I just said a lot there, but the science is something one should look at very carefully, and one should be very skeptical of statements coming from the National Institute of Drug Abuse and Drug Enforcement Administration in this area, because it's really, I hesitate to say it like this, but it's almost that the drug war scoundrel's last refuge is protecting the children. And it really doesn't hold water when you look at it very carefully. You could argue, as some have, that it's prohibition of marijuana that puts children in danger, not the other way around.
As we see states changing these laws, there's already been conflict on medical marijuana between federal drug enforcement and state legalizations. Is that going to happen? How's that going to play out as states legalize recreational use of marijuana?
It's difficult to say. You know, it's a phenomenon that's very difficult, I think, for law enforcement on a federal level or other level to contain at this point. And we can debate whether the Obama administration, the Justice Department, appearing to back off and allowing this experiment to unfold in Washington, Colorado, if that's the right policy or not. But you have to ask yourself, well, what is really the alternatives at this point? Tens of millions of people in the United States smoke marijuana. Millions more use it for medicinal purposes. How are you going to stop such a phenomenon? It's a weed. It grows practically anywhere. So realistically, the federal government can make things difficult, and state governments in other states, but they can't really stop this phenomenon. They can try to drive it underground and push it into a black market, but they can't really ultimately control it. And that's one of the great ironies. Marijuana is a controlled substance yet its use proliferates in an uncontrolled manner throughout the country.
We're talking with Martin Lee, author of Smoke Signals, about America's changing attitude toward marijuana, and we want to hear from you. Are you part of this 55% of Americans that polls suggest support the legalization of cannabis, or do you oppose it? Would you like this to happen here in Wisconsin, what they've done in Colorado, legalizing recreational sales of marijuana? Give a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email talk@WPR.org.
The news is next, and then we'll take your calls. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking with Martin Lee, author of the book Smoke Signals, about the country's changing attitude towards marijuana. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Why do you think attitudes have changed over the past 25 years or so? A big jump in support, according to recent polls. Majority support for legalization, in fact. 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. We'll go to our callers now. We have Duncan with us in Appleton. Duncan, hi.
Hey, everyone. What did our nation's war on drugs, poverty, and I forget what other battles and military battles? We always demonize the foe. And my favorite story is in the mid-70s, a friend and I both got a broken leg on a motorcycle. In the afternoon, our friends came over with some pot brownies, and we ate them that night. And the next morning, the nurse said, "I've never seen two people sleep so well after broken bone."
That's all right. My comment. Thanks for the call, Duncan. Let's tackle that first point, Martin, that if people characterize as a war on drugs, the enemy, in this case, marijuana, got maybe overly demonized, he says.
I think clearly that's the case. You know, marijuana prohibition going back to the 1930s, if I can be very blunt about it, is built on a mountain of lies, and people are seeing through those lies, and that's why you have one of the reasons why you have such a dramatic shift in attitude toward marijuana and the question of legalization. With respect to marijuana and sleep, yes, it is one of the things that people report, at least sometimes some people, that it does help sleep. It has served as a substitute for drugs like Valium, and that's a positive because marijuana is not addictive, and you can't overdose in the way you can with Valium, which could be fatal. But then again, on the other hand, some people report when they use marijuana a lot, it disrupts their sleep patterns, and it throws off their. So I think one shouldn't take this lightly and to make too many assumptions about seeing it as a magic bullet for things. But if used correctly, if used well, if used therapeutically in a conscious way, it could help conditions like insomnia and or sleep-related illnesses, for sure.
Martin, before we go back to our callers, I'd like you to talk a little bit, if you would, about legalization as a political movement. What has been out there advocating for legalization, maybe from the lean years of the 80s with so little support until some successes for them today?
It actually goes back to the 1960s. That's when the marijuana legalization movement began. And at that time, there were many different social movements, an anti-war movement with respect to Vietnam, a feminist movement, a counterculture movement, a gay rights movement. So the marijuana legalization effort was seen as part of a broader movement, if you will, for social justice and civil rights in a diverse sense. And that's the origins of the marijuana legalization movement. And I think sometimes people forget that today. They see it as a single issue, that it's just all about changing the law on this particular area of concern, and that's the most that needs to be done. I really see marijuana legalization as a beginning, not as an end. And the question is, what happens after marijuana legalization? Does it become like big tobacco, and you have big companies that will be selling marijuana cigarettes to any and all concerned, or is it going to be a different model that might unfold? So there's been a long history for the legalization effort. Many different activists have been associated with it, and it's gone through its ups and downs. Certainly the nadir point was in the 1980s, with the just same moment, as it were. But now we see it really cresting, the whole effort.
What would you like the future to look at? Would you like something like a, you know, big tobacco consortium be in charge of most of the industry, or would you like to see a different model, and what would that look like?
I think a different model should be looked at. I think when people talk about the potential economic benefits from legalizing marijuana, clearly if you tax and regulate it, it could fill the state treasuries from that. But one of the misconceptions is that somehow, you know, we're just waiting to untap or to tap into, unleash the economic potential of marijuana. The fact of the matter is there have been tens of thousands of families who have been getting by each year from growing an outdoor marijuana crop, sometimes indoors, particularly in Northern California, Southern Oregon, the so-called Emerald Triangle region of Northern California. That's the cannabis breadbasket. It's been a very important economic factor, a very strong economic medicine, if you will, for people in this region for a long time. The question is, how will it unfold in the future? Will it become something that will be monopolized or dominated by a handful of big corporations? I hope we can steer clear of that model, because it hasn't necessarily been doing a lot of good for most people in the country.
Back to our callers now. We have John with us in Richland Center. John, you're on the air.
Hello. First of all, I'd like to say if I ever knew how much money we get from cigarette taxes, and you know our federal government is looking for more revenue, well, marijuana would be equal to or greater than that amount of tax revenue. And secondly, you would empty 20% of the jail population. And that means you would have to lay off 20% of the jailers. But then again, many lives would be saved because of the street violence. And President Clinton tried it. He advertised it on national media, but he did not inhale.
Gotcha. John, thanks for the call. Let's pursue that. The criminal justice point, that's been an argument from some people in support of marijuana legalization over the years, that we shouldn't be putting police resources into pursuing this, into incarcerating people. How big a factor is that, do you think, Martin, in the changing attitude toward marijuana legalization?
I think this general sense that the drug war with respect to cannabis has failed, that it hasn't achieved the goals that it sought to achieve. It certainly hasn't prevented people from using marijuana. And in countries like Mexico, where there is a great deal of violence associated with or directly connected to the prohibition of drugs in general and marijuana in particular, you know, that's a tremendous human tragedy. But in a state like California, where most of the marijuana is grown within the state that is consumed there, legalizing marijuana in California won't have an immediate impact on the situation in Mexico or on the political violence associated with prohibition, because Mexican marijuana isn't what's feeding the appetite of California marijuana users to begin with. But there's no question that law enforcement has a big stake in this. Probably law enforcement is the biggest obstacle in terms of legalizing marijuana. But there are some law enforcement officers, at least former law enforcement officers and officials, associated with a group called Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, who see through the folly of the drug war and who say that really it is a waste of good police time to be busting people for marijuana when there's far more serious matters for police to attend to with respect to law and order.
And one other argument I've seen is that, of course, the idea that marijuana is a gateway drug, is this gateway legalization? If marijuana, why not cocaine or heroin?
Well, the notion that marijuana is a gateway drug has been debunked many times, even by federal commissions and investigations. The National Institute of Medicine put out a report in 1999 which rejected this idea. This is a National Science Academy that was involved in this research. The idea that marijuana use leads to harder drugs There's no, you know, sort of molecular or biological component to that. Yes, some people use marijuana and then later use other drugs that are more dangerous. But there's nothing inherent in the molecule that compels people to do so. There's many other factors at work here. In terms of legalizing other drugs, well, society has to assess that for itself to see whether prohibition makes sense. Not just with respect to marijuana, but with other drugs. You know, the problem is, in part, that people have been taught for so many years how terrible marijuana is, and then they try it, and they see that their experience doesn't really match what the educators or the federal officials have been saying, and they become very skeptical about the serious dangers involved in more dangerous drugs like cocaine or heroin or alcohol, for that matter. And then they're more likely to try it. So you could say the stepping stone is really the prohibition when it's not based on facts. That's really a stepping stone toward more dangerous situations.
Martin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Martin Lee, author of Smoke Signals, A Social History of Marijuana, Medical, Recreational, and Scientific. It's Teach Me What You Know. Every week we take about 15 minutes to learn a new skill. Last week we learned how to ice fish. If you missed that, you can find it on the Central Time page at WPR.org. This week we're learning how to ace a job interview.
As college seniors return to campus for their final semester before entering the job market, they're doubling down on their preparations. Also, as unemployment remains high in Wisconsin and around the country, performing well in an interview may be the key to getting into the workforce.
Here with advice on how to ace that interview is Andrea Lowe. She's the Career Advising Coordinator at UW-Madison. Andrea, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Andrea, before we can ace an interview, we have to get one. So that's step one. What's the best thing we can do to secure an interview?
It's all about networking nowadays. There's such a hidden job market, so it's all about having some sort of inside information. So doing informational interviewing and kind of becoming the known quantity.
What do you mean by a hidden job market?
There are many positions that are posted, but there are many that aren't. There's also positions that are posted, but they're kind of wired or meant for someone. So just sitting at the computer and hitting apply doesn't take someone as far as it used to.
So when preparing our answers to questions, we've gotten our foot in the door and gotten that interview. What kind of things should we think about?
The first thing I think is to assess yourself. So that means looking over your resume, asking yourself what went well, what was challenging, and thinking of examples of work or projects, whether they were independent or team. The next would be to assess the employer. So looking at their website, looking at their mission statement, their organizational structure. But then also talking to parallel organizations and people who are doing maybe that same kind of position at another organization that maybe you could interview them to find out what they're wrestling with and what's going well for them. And then lastly, it would be to assess your skills and interests and to see how they fit with the employer. So that would mean going through and dissecting the job listing. I usually tell people to take a Word document, copy and paste the position description right into it, and then fill in the blanks of how you meet what their requirements are. You kind of want to put all those pieces together to show that you're the best fit for the position.
Now, you mentioned that it's okay to interview parallel organizations and get a sense. Is that acceptable these days? We can just call somebody up from a parallel organization and say, I'm not applying for a job with you, but I'm interested about this industry. That's something that people can do?
Oh, most definitely. I've done it many times, and it's helped me to become very successful with the jobs I've interviewed for.
Do you ask for HR?
No, I would talk directly to the person who is doing a position that's similar to the one that you're going for, and just do an informational interview. Just find out, you know, what kind of challenges do you have? What are some skills that you need to be successful in your position, so that you can really know, you know, kind of what you're getting yourself into, as well as be able to speak kind of the lingo that they're probably looking for.
All right, what can we do to practice leading up to the interview?
I think there's multiple ways, but it's really coming up with a repertoire of stories. So, and it's also practicing either with someone that you know or maybe you don't know, as well as, you know, if that doesn't work, even doing it in front of a mirror. I think a lot of times people feel like they can just wing it. You know, they know themselves well, or they know that they think they know the job, but it's different when it's coming out of your mouth and if you don't know the questions they're going to ask. We like to use acronyms to help us, remember what we should be talking about. And the one I like is CAR. The C stands for context and challenge. A stands for action. And then R stands for result. So that way, when you're coming up with your stories, it helps you keep it to that kind of two-minute maximum to be able to tell all the different pieces of the examples of how you've, you know, maybe accomplished something or challenges that you've had.
How long should your answers generally be once you're inside that interview?
I think it's, you know, I would say 2 minutes is probably the maximum. That's kind of as long as, that's kind of the most that you're going to keep somebody's attention and to kind of stay on topic.
So day of interview, how should we prepare? What do we do leading up to the event?
I think, you know, after you've done all the assessment of all sides, it's all about, you know, making sure that you have the appropriate professional dress that you've set up. I usually tell people to go and, you know, even if it's the day before, to map out where you're going. A lot of times if you have to take the bus or, you know, parking might be tricky, especially if it's, you know, in a downtown area. And, you know, make sure you have some resumes printed out. And I usually tell people to get to the interview area, so maybe not the actual office or wherever you'll be, maybe a half an hour before, so at a local coffee shop, just to kind of collect your thoughts. And then get to the office where you're actually going to be interviewing maybe about 10 minutes before, because it's very awkward when people show up really early.
Any ideas about dress that matter? I mean, I suppose you wouldn't want to go too casual. Can you go too formal?
Sometimes you could go too formal. I think the thing to know, though, is that you'll most likely be the best-dressed person in the room, and that's okay. I think there are times, though, when, you know, let's say it's a startup or a very casual office, you may want to find out kind of what the dress code typically is, but then take it up a notch. So if you did get there and you are really overdressed, let's say everybody else is in shorts and T-shirts, you know, you could kind of make a joke of it and take your jacket and put it on the chair or something. But it's typical that you're going to probably be the best dressed person because you're showing kind of what your best could look like, especially if you are going to represent the organization.
Assuming we've got the clothes right, now how do we make a good first impression?
First impression, I think a lot of times people overlook the interaction that you have with kind of the frontline staff, so whether it's a receptionist or the person who's assisting with the interview process. That person usually gets asked later on, you know, what their first impressions were of you. So, you know, making sure that you're very cordial and kind of yourself and authentic, but, you know, being friendly with that person. And then, you know, it's all about a nice firm handshake, not too firm, and kind of introducing yourself and letting the employer take the lead on where you should sit, kind of letting them set the stage of what the interview is going to be.
So I think it's happened to most people in an interview where they get a question that they're just pretty much blindsided by, no matter how much that they practice. Are there ways to deal with that, you know, kind of out-of-body experience where you realize you have nothing at your fingertips and to gracefully work your way into an answer?
Yeah, I mean, it's happened to the best of us. I think it's just a matter of, you know, whether it's you're just kind of having the brain block. A strategy could be that, you know, you get they ask the question and you respond with, "Wow, that's a great question," or "That's a tough question. Can I have a moment to think about that?" I do like the strategy of having some sort of padfolio with your, you know, copies of your resume and a list of your questions you're going to ask, but also a blank sheet of pad paper that you could jot down just a couple of notes or keywords, because sometimes when you see a word, it might jog your memory. But you know, there's also ways of maybe you don't have an example of something exactly like they're talking about, but you have something that's somewhat similar or transferable. But there is also the time where you just have nothing. It's happened to me. And so that's when you say, you know, "I'm sorry, but I'm just not coming up with an example at this time." You know, you could try your hardest, but sometimes it doesn't come. The way to kind of save that type of situation would be to follow up, and this is if you were able to find an answer after the interview, that in your thank you note that you address that, how you would have approached that difficult question.
How about the question that I always hate to get in an interview? What's your biggest weakness, your biggest failing, or whatever? I'm sometimes tempted to just say, "Well, I steal a lot of stuff from the workplace," just to, like, you know, what, I'm going to say something really bad about myself? How do you tackle that question?
You know, what they're really looking for is self-awareness. So you don't want to have the canned response, such as, "Well, I'm a perfectionist," or "I'm a workaholic," I think the worst one I ever heard was somebody said that, you know, their weakness was chocolate ice cream or something. Because it's, you know, it kind of shows goofiness in a certain type of sense of humor. I usually go with, you know, the one I always use and share with other people is you come up with something that it's something that maybe you're challenged by, but you've worked on it or you've found ways to overcome it. The example I always use is, there's kind of a big difference between being very detail-oriented versus this person who's very big picture. So if I'm very detail-oriented, I'll say, my natural inclination is to go to that right away. And so I know that's an area where I have to stop myself and say, wait, what's the purpose here? The other strategy I use is I try, if it's a team type of project, I find people who have that other side of the continuum so that it can kind of balance me out. So it's being self-aware and knowing that, you know, it's not necessarily a really strong weakness, but it's something that you know how to work with. And so that typically has been a pretty good example.
In terms of body language during an interview, are there rules of thumb that we might overlook? Eye contact. Is eye contact helpful with each member of the committee, say? Or what about if they give you a glass of water? Mm-hmm. Is it unbecoming if you actually slurp from the water glass during your interview? Yeah. Are there things like that we should be aware of?
Yeah, I mean, eye contact is kind of a given nowadays. I think where sometimes people get confused is if there's several people that are interviewing you that some people think that you should only look at the person who asked you the question, and that's really not the case. It's almost like giving a speech where you should be making eye contact with all the members of the audience. People may have their heads down writing, but just kind of make your rounds with your eye contact to everybody so that everybody feels like they're included. If they do give you water, whether you're thirsty or not, I would take it, because when you're anxious or nervous, that's all of a sudden when your voice goes. I would just say that, you know, if you're offered, take that. The other nonverbals would be to show you're a good listener. So kind of the act of listening nonverbals are to when they're speaking, to lean in just a little bit, to nod. The other reason to practice with someone is to find out, do I do annoying things? Do I use my hands too much that it's distracting? Am I flipping my hair or am I tapping my pen? Because you don't want to distract from your words. So I think those are really important too.
Briefly, the job market is tough these days. It can be a long process. Can you leave us with just a bit of advice for making it through the ups and downs?
I think it's all about your support system. We all have people in our lives that are good or challenged by this. So I think it's finding the right people that will maybe help you mourn the loss of something you thought you were going to get, but then within a week or a couple of days, kind of get you excited for that next thing. You don't want to be around the person who's, you know, going to kind of keep you down because it comes across in the interview.
Andrea, thank you so much for joining us and teaching us some things about job interviews.
Great, thank you.
We've been speaking with Andrea Lowe, Career Advising Coordinator at UW-Madison.
You can find more of our Teach Me What You Know segments online at WPR.org. You can learn something new every Tuesday at this time.
Next is the news, and then we'll look at a federal investigation into insider trading at a successful Wall Street hedge firm. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.